Blog Talk Radio.
Found us, the Sonic Home Companion, for the 123rd day of the year. There's only 242 days left, so prepare for 2016. I think the celebration should be starting anytime soon. We have a remarkably interesting show today. I think a little slight departure. Thank you for last week, the Stick and Stone Cathedral of Mind. I thank you for tuning in and for the response. It was remarkable. I think that today we're looking at need to ask you the pertinent questions as usual, and I hope that you're all doing remarkably well in this. What are we now? May. We have Mother's Day coming up. That will be something for the people in advantaged positions to celebrate and acknowledge. It's a modern celebration, and it's honoring the notion or the role of motherhood and maternal bonds. It really began. This is something that began in the United States in the early 20th century. And it's not related to celebrations of mothers and you know, motherhood that have occurred through the world over thousands of years. This goes back to the Sibylle culture in Greece and the Roman festival of Hilaria and the Christian Mothering Sunday celebration. Some countries, Mother's Day has become synonymous with these older traditions, and I think that's remarkable. It was first, you know, if you have to draw a line and say when was it started, 1908. And this is a woman, as a matter of fact, Anna Jarvis, held a memorial in West Virginia in Grafton to a memorial for her mother. And Mother's Day has been a recognized holiday in the United States since 1905. So, you know, that's the year that Ann Reeves Jarvis died, the woman's mom. But there you have it, a little bit of history about Mother's Day, second Sunday in May. And make it count. This is something that matters in the grand scheme of things. We are remarkable. If we can acknowledge this type of holiday, it's not a holiday, it's an acknowledgement, it's a celebration. We should also give thanks for what we have, on all that we have, particularly in a world where relatively few can claim to live in such safety and with such abundance around us. And it's not ever right. As a matter of fact, it's tasteless to be indifferent to the situation of other people going on. But to be constantly focused on that is draining, is it not? So as we go about our business, we need to, I don't know, I don't think there is a proper level of respect or acknowledgement. There is neglect, we know that, but give it its propers, give it its dues. We need to rely a little bit on the works of Socrates to help us with this. He tells us what it means. You know, we should know ourselves and measure that we should know our souls. One, to know ourselves, you ask always the essential questions here on Masonic Home Companion. But he, as he said, he without eidos, A-I-D-O-S, is a disease to the city. Zeus in a Greek text. Eidos means a sense of shame and knowing your placeness. So if you're in the city and you don't have that sense of shame or knowing your placeness, you know, who you are in the order of things, then he considered that person would be a disease. These are bits and pieces that have come down to us because they resonate, because they make sense. Only if we try to make the effort to put them into some context. That said, I think we have I'm referring to the work of Aristotle today, and just a little bit of a background. This was the Greek philosopher and a scientist born in the Macedonian city of Stangria, and his dad, Nicomachus, died when Aristotle was just a child. So we're not really sure if Proxenus was his guardian, but we think so. And when he was 18 years old, he joined Plato's academy in Athens, and he was there until the age of 37. Yeah. So this is a fellow that's passed down early writings on physics, biology, zoology, poetry, metaphysics, the theater, rhetoric, music. This is a polymath. Right after Plato died, you know, Aristotle left Athens and at the request of Philip of Macedon, Philip asked him to tutor his son, Alexander the Great. And so in 343, that relationship began. Some declare that Aristotle was the first genuine scientist in history. And from that, every scientist is in his debt. So we know that the scientific method is different than trying to prove what we already know. It's that state of discovery, learning and examining so-called failure. So-called because we examine, whatever we try to do is a learning opportunity. Ruling it out takes us one step closer to our goal. So in that sense, you know, who could deny this? Do a little bit of reading about Aristotle. This is a man that Cicero described as his literary style as a river of gold. Can you imagine? Marcus Tullius Cicero doesn't talk about us anymore. He was one of Rome's greatest orators, of course, but if he gives you these propers, Aristotle, these propers, it's remarkable because we're guessing that only about a third of what he produced has survived to this day. Maybe we'll find a sort of a hidden vault or a cave somewhere, and it'll be discovered that there's this library that's of the lost works. We can always dream, can't we? I wanted to talk to you about the process of masonry, and I was working and pondering this over and over, how to put it into something that was manageable. I tend to think as we examine the history of Freemasonry over the years, that there have been changes, but to define what those changes are is really interesting. And I'm not talking about these sort of the numbers that are floating up and down. We float up and down like a cork on the surface of the ocean. And we don't criticize the cork when it's at the trough of the wave, and we don't praise it when it's at the peak, because it's just floating along. It takes the course dependent on what forces and influences, wind, temperature, that is happening at that moment. And it lies in a bobs. It's never really immobile. Even on a flat sea, it will still bob and move, because what's under that surface is constantly in motion. There's currents. But how to take that kind of thinking and apply it to Masonry? Well, I think that the listeners that tune in here are a group aside from the mainstream. And I think what we know, and I want to put this out, challenge you with this one. What we know about Freemasonry has been handled by the academics. Now, we realized that some realized that there were, back in the day, there were exposés, you know, about the secrets of Freemasonry. And it was noticed that these were being grabbed up by Masons because it helped them to learn and understand the ritual. Because there was a day when there wasn't a lack of uniformity. So the boys were all, you know, very curious. What is it and how do we go about it? Well, you know, if it's only passed down because some person in a particular lodge says, well, this is the way we're going to do it, you know, all that blah, 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 local tradition stuff. And it has its proper place, except for people like me that prefer to adhere to the original local traditions, which are, I think, vastly more interesting and time proven. But that's a matter for your opinion. You're welcome to it. But the way that we learn, we wanted to be able to communicate so that there was some degree of connection, a greater degree of connection, other than the pretty baubles and ribbons that we tend to wear. And the back in the day where we were going through this very odd process of still telling ourselves, you know, a bit delusional, that we're a very private and an exclusive club, group, fraternity, beyond definition, certainly beyond the intellectual capacity of those around us who could never truly understand. It's beginning to frame us in a particularly interesting way when we talk like that. This is where we get out the pyre and throw people like me on it. But what seems to have drifted away from us with the climate is what's eroded is the academic. I believe that we can agree from the onset, whether we're talking about the if you want to talk about provenance, somewhere in Scotland, somewhere in the thinking of the Celts out of Ireland, somewhere out of Britain, somewhere out of the Hasanic principalities, you know. Somewhere there were these ideas, these groups forming, where ideas, profound ideas, were being shared. And we seemed quite startled after being cleansed by the temperance movement that there was drink and conviviality going on, that there were men only. So we run into a bit of harsh criticism today because We know that there, in the politic, the body politic, there is only uniformity. People like me refer to that as atrophy. Entropy, atrophy, you do the math. The work, though, is the conversation we found was not that different. There were where men were mindful and they had a sense of understanding the universe that that we live in. We find that through time, essential questions are being asked, and this is the one of the uniformities that Freemasonry keeps connecting. And it's not owned, it's not defined by any one particular group. It's a collective consciousness, as Carl Jung helped define it for us. The work, though, isn't about provenance. It's this interesting phenomena. It's like saying art was created by one particular culture. Well, we know that we have evidence that expression of art, expression in art form, happens in cultures, in various cultures, but we know that it is one of the uniformities, don't we? We know that some expression or appreciation of creation, of the source and origin, some sense of awe about the stars and the moon and the cycles of the weather are commonplace. What makes us remarkable creatures is the amount of genius that has occurred. I don't mean in the sense of the Columbus types of discoveries, you know, where somebody claims to discover something that was discovered many, many years before. You know, somebody, you know, the Thomas Edisons of the world, and that sandbagged a lot of ideas. But today he's given credit for stuff. And Columbus, well, you really didn't discover much, because did you notice there, buddy, there are very old established cultures in the place that you discovered. That's a way over the top with the ethnocentrism, don't you think there? But anyway, I digress. Haiku, why make it as simple as possible? I began to think I have to apply some rules to this thinking, because it's like I would tire you with just more ongoing opinion. So I applied the rule of Occam's razor. I'm just going to say ladder. Occam's razor, you've probably have heard that. It's a something that's a commonplace. This is it's OCCA, or it can be OCKHAM, and it means the law of parsimony. I always think that a guy came up with this, William of Occam. 1287, the 1340s, you know, that's 13th century kind of guy, who was an English Franciscan friar and scholastic philosopher and theologian. And this principle states that among competing hypotheses that predict equally well, the one with the fewest assumptions should be selected. The one with the fewest assumptions. Other, more complicated solutions may ultimately prove to provide better predictions, but in the absence of differences of predictive ability, the fewer assumptions that are made, the better. So we can use this principle to shift the burden of proof in a discussion. Yeah. Now think about using this just for a moment. Suspend your sense of reason and apply this to Masonry. How do we understand the change that has occurred? So just park aside that we're in this little cork arc or through time. And And we float along regardless of the forces and always will. There's a declaration that most of us agree. So that the number of little quarks in the ocean don't really matter. The physics of being a little quark in a great big ocean remain the same. And whether it's a German quark or a Scottish quark or a French quark, we can all point fingers and notice that the French quark is more delicate and the Scottish quark has a sound like a bagpipe if you listen, put it up to your ear. But the quark, the dynamics of the quarks remain the same. The loss of education, of an academic stream, I think it may be a misnomer. It's not that we've lost it, but the appeal is different. This was, education was at one time a privileged state. Now it's almost become, well, not almost, people in this country actually mock it. Hard to believe that a Freemason would be amongst that group. Let's make sure that nobody that declares himself as a Freemason would ever mock education, would ever mock the arts and sciences. It's really a contradiction, isn't it? What you do about the arts and sciences to improve yourself, if you're thinking that somebody's going to force you to do it, grow up. You're a grown man. Nobody forces you. If you want to be head in the sand, go ahead. If that's your taste, but do it well. Don't do it because it's easy or convenient or you're lazy. Conduct your life as if you're putting some effort into understanding what's going on around. Otherwise, we've discounted the lessons taught through our initiations, haven't we? Listen for a moment to this piece on the haiku of masonry. Haiku, just again, it's just a Japanese verse in three lines. And the first line has five syllables, the second has seven, and the third has five. So five, seven, five. And it's a mood poem. And it doesn't use any metaphors or any similes. Usually haiku is taught, the students are only given the restriction of the number of lines. So you have this restriction. I want you to create the story, a mood. Tell me the mood of Freemasonry in haiku. Five, seven, five syllables. All right? That's my challenge for you. An old silent pond. A frog jumps into the pond. Splash. Silence again. This is 17th century stuff from Cody. Autumn moonlight. A worm digs silently into the chestnut. A summer river being crossed. How pleasing. With sandals in my hands. There you go. 5, 7, 5. Light of the moon moves west. Flowers' shadows creep eastward. Have to think about it, don't you? Of course. If there is a fault of a good master, it is pushing his talented apprentice beyond his pace. In a sense, it is failing him. In another, the demanding master may get a result, pushing raw talent to a higher level. The balance is suppressing imagination too much too soon. Natural talent is rare. Developed talent depends on effort and ability. And patience. A good life depends on outlook. If only life were a dress rehearsal, there would be a chance for a do-over. Maturity of mind and emotion often releases after the fact insight. The maturity of the mind, it's after the fact that we learn the lessons. Then we learn from the efforts and behaviors, experiences of others, if we are able to study, and then apply those other experiences to our own lives. Tell me, from your own experience, does this account for the majority or minority of mature men? Around you, do you see change? Freemasonry is not a task, but a calling that requires effort. Whether you fall into this opportunity by caprice or design is a petty distinction, but one that exists. I'm saying it really doesn't matter how you get there, how you got to the door. Thank goodness you did. Regardless, be gentle and generous with brethren, but never expect that from others. It's your character. It's not a currency to be traded. I'm only gentle and generous when everybody else around me is. That's payment. That's paying for affection, paying for dignity. Cheapens the expression, the process. You can stand on reputation, but remember, changing the way you are seen by others lags behind your own sense of change. As Freemasonry reinvents you, be patient. What are the essential questions? Maybe the most important is life worth living? Answers will likely come from places otherwise unexplored. Means that we need to stretch ourselves. You can stand on reputation. At times, we follow. At times, we stumble. At times, we walk with eyes fixed on the horizon, confident we will deal with whatever comes. We learn from various sources. There is perfection in simplicity, what some call Occam's razor. What is the nature of Freemasonry then? For some, Freemasonry is the haiku of arts and sciences. Let it penetrate your being. The philosophy works only if you let it. Letting it is doing the remarkably small tasks, the menial tasks, the demeaning tasks, whatever those are. I never saw them in Freemasonry. Doing it all. Savoring the harvest, working hard to seed the crops and the ideas. Challenging yourself. Challenging isn't, Freemasonry is not about accepting the things and doing the things that please you. It's exploring exploring those things that don't please. It's developing a sense of being able to look through the eyes of someone else and look at yourself. Transformation is the result of doing the work, smallest and largest, quick and tedious, and doing so willingly, only if you are willing. Otherwise, run away for another day. It's that willingness to understand. I want to talk a little bit about that seeing things through the eyes of someone else. And I've been reading about, you know, the sense of the creation of the developer, the creator of God. And I began to realize or find material on the Quran. And I had to admit, I know very, very little about it. Now, this is a quote that I think really helped me. It might help you. The reverence and mystery that Christians feel toward Jesus, the Christ, is what Muslims feel toward their book. I had no idea. Sacred, the sacred. Few notions are more difficult for a Westerner to grasp than the dogma of the uncreated Quran. The contrast between Hebrew and Christian views of the Creator and Muslim view appears wherever we look, in the creeds and the traditions and the visions of Islam. This, as much as anything else, makes it hard for us in the West to feel at home with Islam. For Islam found the very notion of creation unappealing. The first decisive yet unfamiliar evidence is the Muslim view of Holy Scripture. The Muslim counterpart to Jesus is not Muhammad. Christians believe in the incarnation, the taking on of a human form by Jesus, conceived as the Son of God. But Muslims believe in inlibration, the embodiment of God in a book, in the Word. That book is the Quran. The reverence and mystery that we feel towards Jesus the Christ is what they feel toward that book. It puts it into context for us. The book written at a different time, just like the Bible was written at a different time. If you take the Bible literally, it seems quite bizarre. It can seem quite bizarre. Do we apply the same? What part of the Quran, then, is for literal and what's for metaphoric use? But if the Quran were eternal, there would be two eternals, it says. This is from the critic Ash Sharastani. He died in 1153. And he summarized what was known as the Mu'tazilite argument, that the Quran, along with speech itself, must have been created. Now, this is a matter of knowing, in a sense. How can I possibly know the mind of God? Because I'm not God. How can I possibly offer the judgments of God? Because I'm not God. God, how can I conceive of God? Because God is I am that I am. The puzzles. So you sit down on a rock looking out over the lake and you ask yourself, what in the world does it mean? Or you take brush in hand and you try to explain to yourself, what does it mean? What makes the eternity of speech impossible is that if the speech, which is command and prohibition, were eternal, God would have had to lay commands on himself. The words, take off thy shoes, addressed to Moses when he did not exist, is speech that the non-existent, it's speech with the non-existent. And how can a non-entity be addressed? This is really getting us around to ideas of Platonism, isn't it? We've talked about that earlier on the Masonic Companion. Therefore, all commands and narrations in the Quran must be speech originated at the time the person addressed was spoken to. Therefore, the speech is in time. Ah. What most angered the Orthodox was this suggestion that the Quran had actually been created in time. A little deeper thought, the uncreated was that it was there. The theologians, Christian theologians, wrestle with a variation on the same question. Most of us find this heavy going, so we tend to avoid it. The struggle over whether the Quran was uncreated and existed from eternity, or whether it was created at a particular time by God and hence not eternal, was no arcane quibble. This explosive question would not be left to theologians, and it became a crisis in Islam. It was during the brilliant and turbulent reign of the Caliph Hisham of Damascus, the 10th of the great Umayyad caliphs in the East, that the dangerous notion of the created Quran was first seriously proposed. Let's at least allow some degree of dignity and accept that there are similar questions within the faiths of mankind, humanity. Similar questions that are difficult to necessarily answer, or to the question like, how do we, not whether there is a created or uncreated, but how do we resolve that discussion? How do we find the balance point between these discussions? Oh, how many hundreds of years did Britain experience, the people of Britain experience, or of Europe experience, these massive wars over a religious perspective? Christian A killing Christian B because they leaned in different ways. So this topic that I'm talking about is very sensitive and very volatile. But for people who are not of Islam and not of the Prophet, may peace be with him, if we struggle to understand, that's important. We begin asking questions and searching for answers, because the faith is one that creates balance within the mind of the followers. So if we're going to apply, you know, 5th century sense of justice and reckoning, punishment, let's do it across the board, not just in the Middle East, and not just for everywhere the Arab language was spoken, but for all of it. We seem a little more dire, don't we? We may not have blood on our hands and our conscience as well. So you come up with this. You think, just when we think that there's one answer, and it, because it's ours, and it's the way that we, you know, if we, it works for us, it needs to work for everybody. And darn those other questions, they're obviously wrong-minded. But just when we begin to, you know, feel that smugness, somebody whispers in our ear, you know, it's time to examine, be aware of our own smugness and see, you know, because it's a shortcoming. Some Freemasonry being something greater than what we are, Freemasonry being more than the collective opinions and minds of Masons. In its perfect state, it offers us a sense of being able to describe perfections and perfect states. But we have to do the work. Otherwise, it's just rhetoric, just words. Words with no meaning. Events without meaning, unless we understand. What does it mean? So very few times have I ever heard that kind of question asked. And I think it's appropriate, because not everybody is at that point. And I don't think this should be necessarily the dominant theme of lodge meetings. It's one of many. Now, I know that there are certain lodges that form around a dedication to asking these essential questions. Strict observance, for example. But it doesn't take away from the effort of the individual intellect. That's where the work occurs, in your mind. Now, what are you reading? What are you studying? What are you listening to? What track are you following in your thoughts? Masonry, after all, is a process of self-awareness. But have you ever asked, why in the world do we need philosophy at all? You know, we spend a lot of our time and our energy getting by, working hard, taking care of the business in front of us. And at the end of the day, it's hard to step aside and have enough energy, isn't it? Unless we're living that complete a lifestyle, why don't we give more time to the philosophical discussion? Because we have other priorities. Oh my goodness, is this a declaration that philosophy isn't important? No. It's simply that we have other priorities. Get with the program. Why do we need this? You ever ask yourself, why? Why is it part of the lexicon of masonry? Why? Let's consider this just for a second, that the very need for philosophy became a question. Right, in our time. That we're not assuming that it is essential. A reason often given for the contemporary question concerning the need or role of philosophy is that philosophy from the Middle Ages until the end of the 19th century, in fact, was heavily invested in two ontotheological ideas. That's sort of a metaphysical come theological idea, namely the idea of God. Although the God of the philosophers was always very different from God of the celebrated man, the man and woman on the street, and the idea of the immateriality of the soul. Although most 19th century scientists were still churchgoers, the posture of 20th century and now 21st century science was decidedly secular and analytic. Philosophy, for the most part, has the same posture. That is not to say that there are not scientists or analytic philosophers who are religious, but the idea of God as an entity we need to postulate in order to account for the existence of the natural world or as a foundation for morality is no longer widely accepted. In fact, if you look at Jewish philosophy as a guide to life, current religious standpoint is somewhere between John Dewey, he wrote A Common Faith, and Martin Buber. Dewey saying that the kind of reality God has is the reality of an ideal. And that is the way most of us do. That's the way we conceive of God. It's an ideal. But that is not the subject of this chapter. For the large number of people, including many religious people who have lost the belief in the God of ontotheology, the metaphysical first cause, ens necessarium, and now find themselves unable to believe in the God of the unreflective believer or in life after death, it can seem that the whole of philosophy between Plato and Hegel was a vast mistake. Heidegger proclaimed at the end of the ontotheology seemed to amount to showing the fly the way out of the fly bottle. Not only has belief in God as God was traditionally conceived ceased to be something that educated people take for granted in the West, but the successes of evolutionary biology, genetics, and computer science and brain science have demolished the idea that the seat of our mental faculties must be an immaterial soul. Many natural scientists are hostile to traditional philosophy and are glad to dismiss it as obsolete. But they're not necessarily particularly friendly to analytic philosophy because they often regard that as scientifically uninformed hair splitting. Even if the enormous prestige and enormous success of science have not jeopardized the position of the humanities as a whole, as important disciplines, which they have, which is curious, they have called into question the raison d'etre of philosophy. Is philosophy really just a relic from past ages that we need either to discard or to replace with something else? even if we disguise the fact that the latter is what we are doing by retaining the word philosophy. Now let's look at what's called logical positivism as a failed response. Logical positivism is a product of the combined influence of the great physicist Ernst Mach's version of empiricism and Bertrand Russell's belief that in the new logic that he and Whitehead did so much to perfect, a tool had been discovered that would either solve or dissolve the traditional problems of philosophy once and for all. It was thus a decided 20th century movement. In The Logical Construction of the World, which was published in 1928, there's still an interest in epistemology. And Husserl is even cited as a forerunner. But in 1934, a fellow by the name of Carnap wrote the following words: "All statements belong to metaphysics. Regulative ethics and metaphysical epistemology have this defect. Are in fact unverifiable and therefore unscientific. In the Viennese circle, we are accustomed to describe such statements as nonsense." Not to mince your words, you know, if you don't like something, just I just wonder, brethren, if anybody feels that we don't have a sense of what's on this fellow's mind. We need to. I know we're throwing out different terms here. Epistemology, that's a theory of knowledge, and especially with regard to its methods of validity and scope of knowledge. It's the investigation of what distinguishes justified belief from opinion. Now, we've talked about the lessons from Plato about the truth and opinion. All opinion is valid. Yeah, and this is really the term for this, the investigation that distinguishes whether it's truth or opinion. It's still a belief. How do you know one is justified? How do you know that your opinions are justified? Oh, well, because I say so. Tame that ego. Or pour that boy another round. Give him, you know, pour him another drink. You're at that point, everything coming out of your cake hole is just the way the world is. Woo! Aren't you a lucky boy? And so, epistemology. So just when you hear that, just think between justified belief and opinion. That's what we're talking about here. So what is left for philosophers to do? If we have that, epistemology is looking at that, what did the philosophers do? The logical positivists continue to teach in philosophy departments still. And they publish, and they even create new philosophy journals. This might lead one to expect that Carnap, in his work looking at epistemology, must then have proceeded to prove a number of results in a scientific field. But one would be wrong. In all the books and papers that Carnap wrote, books and papers that are rightly prized as brilliant contributions to important philosophical debates, there is, to be blunt, not one contribution to anything that anyone today recognizes as logical science. There are attempts to reduce non-observational terms in science to observational terms, like atom, gene, gravitational field. Like, we don't see those. There was an attempt in the book The Logical Syntax of Language Itself to provide a syntactic characterization of analytical sentences. There was an attempt to formalize inductive logic, which results universally regarded as disappointed. We'll go on another time. This is at one of those banquets that's best taken over ours because the meal is just a little too rich. Have I convinced you that academia has been leached out of the soil of Freemasonry? And it's now, instead of being uniform, it's in small pockets where people are striving for those for a belief that is an observed belief that is proved. Is there something behind it or not? So more than anything else, we want to know, do we discard it or do we use it? So that's really what we're talking about. Is it justified? Are the beliefs justified? Whether we're looking at the proof. Masonry often gives us the answers. Remember when you're in school and Miss Thornell would say, Dale, you have to prove how you came up with that answer. Oh, well, okay. The proof was the mathematics. The answer wasn't what she was after. So those pockets still exist, but as pockets, the priorities of the day, the forces of the day made that little cork through time move offshore and then into protected bays and coves and out into the center of stormy weather. Always moving along the surface, unremarkably. So when we're gnashing our teeth and renting our clothes, we are doing that for nothing. Unless we're going to change physics, what's the point? Physics doesn't change just because we throw ourselves in the ground and pound our fists. Freemasonry is what it is. It's a process. The process, or if you want, an outcome of various forces or influences, seen and unseen, the physical and metaphysical. And I say that where we're at now, looking for the quality, is a return to that point of academic influence. Now, this said, not everybody is going to be swept up into this. Just like today, everybody's not swept up into the movement of increased volumes being the goal. There is this other way of thinking about the quality. So we seem to want to stand on one side of the bridge saying we're dedicated to increasing the volumes. That's really important. But we also want to increase the quality. So let's see if we can improve the quality and see if we can marry the two ideas so that we have the influence. A bit idealistic? Well, of course it is. Well, my goodness, isn't it? But isn't that what Masons often cling to? So this, in the 21st century, we put our mind to a new set of complications, a new awareness of processes that were always in place. And from that work, we will begin to understand what our next moves need to be, because that information is less guesswork and more an extrapolation of an understanding of these different principles. Understand the physics of Freemasonry. Understand the philosophy of Freemasonry. Understand the permanence of these ideas, the endurability. And it allows us to stop looking over our shoulder and fretting and start to look ahead. How do we do this in a comfortable, gentlemanly way? Well, we will use the scientific method, but let's not discount totally that philosophy has a role in this, or as our science friend is suggesting, begin to question whether it's just unjustified belief. Philosophy doesn't really add to the discussions. Thank you for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here. I will look forward to speaking with you, being with you in a week's time. And we're going to get that much closer to the equinox. It's coming up, and it's only 43 days away, 43 days, 14 hours. So we're going to have to think of something to do to in the meantime. It's coming. I'm just going to check out here how many days left until Christmas. There you go. Oh, you know that already. 235 days in 15 hours. So you're all equipped to get through the week. Here's some sweet music that in line with the idea. Remember, 575. Do your haiku. Send them to me. MasonicClubCompanion@gmail.com. And a serial soon. May the great architect keep an eye on you.